Greetings, all of God's people. This is again Mordecai Joseph. We're today in lesson 212. And we had five parts about the seven laws of successful correction. And that was in the context also. And that was, I thought, very fitting at this point with Joseph, the story of Joseph as we were in it. What God was doing through this whole process of Joseph and his brothers and Jacob and all these people that needed to learn lessons. And you can see again throughout this whole episode, several chapters of God recorded here. It's not just, you know, a lullaby story and a nice story to tell, but there is an awful lot there. And a lot of people obviously missed it as they read through it. And we thought that was a great time at this point to bring the subject of correction, because all the elements here in essence were here. Everybody was doing wrong, and from God's point of view, as righteous as people were, like Jacob and Joseph, you know, later on, obviously he was only 17, he was not that righteous, but he learned many lessons. His own brothers had to learn their lessons, and there was correction there, and there was wrong that was done there, and God brought it all into the front, and they all had to confront that, and be confronted with it, and do something about it. And the end result was what? Total reconciliation between Joseph and his brothers. Even though they had a difficult time, as we mentioned several times, you know, they realized how horrible a thing that they did to their brother, even though they did not kill him, just like literally they did not kill Jesus Christ. But the day will come, as you read in Zechariah 12, when he comes back to them and he offers them the spirit of grace and stuff, and then their eyes are going to be opened, and they would realize, yes, they were guilty, even though personally they haven't done it. Neither the generation, they haven't done it personally. No, it was the Roman soldiers. They were the physical hands that have done it, but all were guilty of it, and God brought the whole story, and he's going to bring it with his own people, Israel. And he's going to bring it with every single one of us. You see, he's going to go through this whole process of correction and bring us to the end of the story. That's how he becomes the author and the finisher of our salvation. And a lot of people, you know, read this statement, and they don't really comprehend what it's really all about, as they should. It's too much superficial knowledge and understanding there on the part of many. And many of us are guilty of that because we're not spending enough time with our Creator, our God, our Maker. You know, just want to do a little bit here and there, you know, like Sabbath services, things like that, and after that, forget all about you. Well, it doesn't work like that. And so that's what we see here at this point in Genesis chapter 50. We're coming back now to Genesis again. And in verse, let's read it again. As they come toward the end, maybe we should read the whole account again after they came back from Canaan. I have to maintain a continuity here again, as we have done before that. And so as they come back from the funeral of Jacob, they are afraid that Joseph is going to hold it against them. And so when Joseph's brethren, verse 15, chapter 50, saw that their father was dead, they said, "It may be that Joseph will hate us and will fully requite us all the evil which we did unto him." Since they were not exposed as they should have been, you know, they had the knowledge of God there, enough of it. And maybe those things were not done properly, and to begin with, you know, there was a bad example of their own father who did not treat all of them equally with love and affection. You know, he treated Joseph in that way, but not the other brothers. So obviously, you know, all of them were not doing things right. The process of the seven laws of the ingredients of the correction and reconciliation and closure and all that, that certainly was not something that they were doing as it should have been. Or otherwise, all these things would not have happened to begin with. And that's the reason why Paul was telling the Corinthians, you know, you better forgive him and conform, you know, that is, comfort him and confirm your love to him, because otherwise it's going to be swallowed with much sorrow. And people in that condition do even most, you know, more bad things to others, as well as to themselves. And so here they are in this condition because of that. That process was not a living process in their own lives. And so that's what he's going to hate them. You know, we've done him wrong, he's going to respond. Well, that's human nature, isn't it? You know, that's the way it is. Now that he's got all of us here, and there is no dad, you know, to protect us, you know, woe unto us. And so the real reconciliation really never happened there. The whole process, you see, was not exhausted there. They didn't go through all of it. And apparently Joseph didn't comfort them enough, didn't reassure them enough throughout all these years for them to come to the point where they realize, hey, don't worry, nothing's going to happen, all is forgotten. So you see, there was something is still missing there, even in Joseph. that he hasn't done enough for them to believe it. And that's the reason why they're still feeling this way. So, you know, through all that, God is exposing us for what we are, and through all that, he also tells us, learn. Learn from all these examples, you see. And people who do not study the law of God, obviously they miss all these opportunities to learn all these lessons and to become like God in the process. To begin with, not to do those things that bring all this pain and affliction on us. And so here it is, you know, they're still afraid, they're still scared, because the process was not really finished. So, the seven-course meal here, so to speak, of correction, reconciliation, restoration, closure. And so they thought, well, he's going to really give it to us now. He's going to hate us. And he will fully requite us all the evil which we did unto him. Now, you wouldn't say that about Joseph. If Joseph spent enough time with them to really, totally, totally heal the whatever happened. So obviously there was something lacking there too on the part of Joseph, or else they wouldn't feel that way. And again, God records that for our admonition. That when we do something like that, we better make sure that there is a total, total forgiveness and healing and reassuring, you see, and comforting and total closure. Or else, some people are going to be constantly haunted by that for the rest of their lives. And after 17 years, still the children of Jacob, the brothers of Joseph, are being haunted with that. So they, obviously something was missing there. And so in verse 16, and they sent a message unto Joseph saying, your father did command before he died. You know, that they have to resort to that lie. That's how scared, you know, and fearful they are. So shall you say unto Joseph, forgive, I pray you, now the transgression of your brethren and their sin. You see, why do they need at this point to say that? Because obviously they didn't feel that he did forgive them. Yes, somehow they got the feeling. Maybe they're wrongly. You see, whichever it may be, he did not reassure them again and again and again to the point where they would realize, hey, it's all gone, forgotten. You see, they haven't got to that point. So we have to learn that if we don't do it all perfectly from the beginning until the end, that's the way people are going to feel about us. And then that makes us a stumbling block to them, and God is going to hold us responsible for it. You know, you haven't gone all the way just as I do. That's the reason why people continue to feel that way in your presence. And so that's what they say. The father supposedly said, you know, forgive the transgression of your brethren and their sin, for that they did unto you is evil. So, you know, they acknowledge that. And now we pray you, forgive the transgression of the servants of the God of your father. And perhaps they felt that Joseph didn't really forgive them. It doesn't mean that he didn't, but they felt that way. And as long as they feel that way, that's the reason why Paul said, and that's what God says through Paul, not only comfort them, not only speak kindly to them, but reaffirm it as many times as you need to until they really know and know that they know that it's all over. You see? It doesn't even exist. You don't even remember it. And so it's very important for us, as we go through this whole process, understand every step is extremely important and must be done right. And that's the reason also, you know, where God records a lot of these things here. It's not because, you know, he wants to tell a nice story. And so, here Joseph again. Joseph wept when they spoke unto him. Maybe he realized, you know, he hadn't done enough to comfort them, to reassure them, to reaffirm it. Whichever it may be. He wept 17 years later, going through it all over again. And his brethren also went and fell down before his face. Look how scared they were of him. And they said, behold, we are your bondmen. And Joseph said unto them, fear not, for am I in the place of God? You see? And he was shocked by that. But then he has to think about it. Maybe I haven't done my job properly, all the way. Why would they be acting like that if I've done my job? You see? That's why, you know, that seventh law that we were talking about there, and before that's number six. You have to comfort. Otherwise, people are going to be swallowed with much sorrow. And imagine the brothers of Joseph, probably for 17 years, in the back of their mind, at least now and then, are saying, man, what's going to happen to us when our dad dies? What's Joseph going to do to us? Imagine the fear and trepidation they had to live through in all these past 17 years. what they had to go through. You see? When we study the law of God, we begin to perceive and understand and discern all these things, and then we realize why every little detail in the mind of God is very important. Why we have to go through all these things. Why not just, okay, I forgive you, that's it. You know, enough, you know, okay, I forgive you, get out of my sight. Well, it doesn't work like that. That's why. And we have to go, you know, give of ourselves. You know, they've done us wrong, but we give of ourselves. We turn around and we hug them and embrace them and kiss them and comfort them and reassure them. You see? You begin to realize what we are made of. We're not like God as we should be. We don't have His nature. You know, that seems to be so foreign to us. You know, why should I do that? You know, I didn't do Him any wrong. He did me wrong. She did me wrong. You know, why should I prostrate myself before them, you know, and, you know, get on my knees and plead with them, please. You know? Forget all about it. Yeah, you know, that exposes us for what we are really made of. And, you know, all of us are guilty. You know, I'm guilty of it. You know, every single one of us is guilty. We know it's not in us to do it with everybody, in every case, with everything. But we have no choice. We're confronted with that. We have to learn. We have to be like God. If we are to be divine beings like Him, we have to be like Him. There is no other way. You know, that's the reason why these things are recorded here in this manner also. And mind you, God is the one recording it before Moses, and He chooses every single word that He records for a purpose, so that we, for generations to come, will study and learn from that. Words become living words, not just a story. That happens once upon a time, you know. Lullaby story you tell on a Sunday school or children before they go to bed. And so He tells them, fear not, for am I in the place of God? And as for you, you meant evil. Yes, okay, you know, this is, you know, I spot the offense. I put the spotlight on it. I'm not going to pretend you didn't do evil. You meant evil, and they did, and they know it too, you see. And they're repenting of it. But that's not enough. So you meant evil, but God meant it for good. You see, that's what we're talking about from the beginning until the end. Every terrible thing, every bad thing, every horrible thing that we've done to others has been done to us, or that people have done to us. You see, be it a father or a mother, brother or sister, you know, a fellow, co-worker, whatever it may be, people that we trusted. Everything is going to be used by God as a tool to make us just like Him. Patient, long-suffering, forgiving, willing to turn around and love our enemies, willing to give our lives for our enemies. You see? Are we going to learn all those things to become like God unless He allows us all the evil? That's why He allows the devil to sit on a throne all these 6,000 years instead of getting rid of him so we can have peace on earth. You see, well, that's not going to fulfill the purpose of God to reproduce Himself, to make people in His own image and likeness. And so, evil is necessary, and some people have a difficulty with that statement when God, and because they don't understand it, they want to apologize for God and explain it away, spiritualize it. No, when God says, I create evil, He means it. He is not evil, but He has, for the sake of the process, to create or to allow the instruments of evil to do their work so that His plan of salvation will become a reality. You see? I mean, you want to wash your car, you know, you take soap and you take sponge and you take this and that, you know, and other things that are tougher, you know, you take all those spot removers, you know, and stain removers. Yeah, you can imagine if your cloth or whatever, you know, you apply it to could scream and yell and yowl. You'll hear it all over the place. So we create those things. You know, just like God, we created all those, you know, quote-unquote evil things, you know, in order to clean our clothes, wash them, make them, you know, bright, clean, white, without stain, without spot, without blemish. There is no other way. That's the reason God allows the devil and his demons on this earth to do all the horrible things, and He does not stop them except when it is against His will. And against His plan, you see. The more you understand it, the more you understand what we're going through in this life and why we have to battle, why we have to resist, why we have to keep our eyes on the picture. What is it that God is doing here through this whole thing? I begin to curse and, you know, get root of bitterness and be angry. You know, because we've been deprived of pleasures. Big deal, you know. All the pleasures we've been deprived of is falsehood. Big deal, you know. All the sorrows, all the grief, all the anguish that we go in this life is not even worthy to be compared with the glory. But what happens when people don't think about the glory which is going to be revealed from on high in the future? They're not able, like our Savior, the Deliverer, you know, the Redeemer, the one that gave His life. They're not able, just like Him, for the joy that was ahead of Him, to endure the shame, the humiliation, the sufferings, the pain, the affliction of the cross. You see? And He said, if you want to follow Me, you better take your cross, and you carry it just like I did, all the way. And when you are even on the cross, so to speak, and they are putting the final, you know, nail into your body, you know, and the spear that is going to ram you through, to that point, you cannot lash back and forget what you are there for. You see? And you should be able to turn around and say, Father, forgive them, for they know not. You see? That's not human. That's a divine nature. We don't have it in us. We are working toward it. But we're given a lot of opportunities, a little bit here and a little bit there. God knows how much we can take to develop that very nature. There is no other way around it. You want to be there for eternity in glory? Be willing to pay the penalty. Count the cost. That's what it means. Now, though, this is what is happening here. And so He said, you meant it evil for Me. And yes, you know, obviously God allowed it, caused it. You see, used their own emotions and feelings and all that. And brought it about. But He said, God meant it for good. You see? It sounds, you know, strange and weird and demented and perverted, you know, to some people because they don't understand it. You know, how can that horrible thing that happened to my daughter, you know, if she was raped and God did nothing about it, He allowed it to happen. Or that horrible thing that happened to me, you know, where somebody did it to me. How can that be, you know, for good? What kind of a God is that? See how we think? That's how the devil began to think. And that's how he became the devil. He began to disagree with God on this point, a little one, then a bigger one, then other points. And now he thinks God is evil and I'm right. And so he likes to appear as an angel of righteousness, angel of light. And his ministers are likewise. And so they become so warped and so perverted. And all of us, you know, will be that way if we don't watch for it. Until we call light darkness, and darkness becomes light. And right becomes wrong, and wrong becomes right. You see, we get so mixed up. So we have to watch those kind of things. When God says He created evil, He means it. He did. He causes it. He allows it. Now, He didn't create the devil, you know. The devil created himself. And so we have to understand also what it means. It doesn't mean that, you know, He created an evil man. But he allows those instruments and at times creates those instruments in the sense that, you know, He raises Nebuchadnezzar. He allows him to be powerful, to rise to power, to be in that office and not somebody else. And then He says, you go and get My kids. You know, they'll be misbehaving. You know, you're the paddle. I want you to go over there. But mind you, when He goes over there, what does He do? You know, He doesn't take, you know, just like a father and takes a paddle and spanks his kid and that's it. No, no. He sends His soldiers over there. They go and butcher people, cut them to pieces, you know, rape women. And so what kind of a God that allows him to do like that actually raises him and brings him over here and even told him that He's going to do it even before it happened? See what I mean? A lot of us really don't know God as we should. Don't know His nature, don't appreciate it for what it is, because we do not understand the whole thing, the whole process, and what is necessary for it. You see? We do the same thing, you know, when we want to wash the car, so to speak, when we want to clean the tough stains and spots and all that. We create those evil things from the point of view of the spots and blemishes in order to remove them. And that's exactly the reason why God does all those things. It does not mean that He's evil. You see, people think, you know, He corrected me, He must be evil, no? He corrected me because He loves me, but we don't see it that way. Kids don't see it that way when they get spanked by their father. They think, well, He hates me. He's after me. And so He says, you know, you've done it, you know, for the wrong attitude, but God meant it for good to bring to pass as it is this day to save much people alive. Now, was it worth it when you think about it that way? The end result? Look at all these millions of people that were saved and our own family. Then you say, well, I guess it was worth it. And after all, you know, we are willing to give so much to get, you know, a corruptible crown, a corruptible, you know, corruptible office. You know, even the President of the United States, what does that mean? You know, 4 years, you're booted out, you know, often time. and or corruptible metal, gold metal, silver, bronze, whatever it may be. Look what people are willing to put themselves into. All those things are sufferings and pain. It's sort of evil, you know, or what, in order to produce what they really are after. So why is it that we're not willing to subject ourselves to the same process? And when we understand, well, maybe we begin to change our mind, begin to see things God's way, not our way, and then all the sicknesses in the family, and the pain, and the affliction, and the sufferings that come upon us, and the insults, and the abuses that we suffered all of our lives, from beginning of life to the day we die, all those things make sense. And then we are grateful to God for them. You know? Sounds weird at the moment, but we're going to get to that point where we're going to be grateful for everything that we went through in this life and what was done to us, because we see the end result of it. You see? And then we're not going to point the finger at God and say, well, you've been around, you saw such and such a person do that to me, you've done nothing about it. You see? None of us is going to stand before the judgment seat of Christ and point the finger at Him. We're going to acknowledge His mercy and kindness and compassion by allowing all those things to produce the end result of what we become, you know, when we are spirit beings. So let's begin to appreciate that while we are alive today and go through it. And so this is what Joseph is trying to convey to them. God meant it for good. That's a powerful statement when you think about all the context and the background behind it. And in order to bring to pass, as it may, to save much people alive. But that was only the beginning. You see, because they were going to become later on a nation. Of course, at this point, they don't know that yet, as they should. And they're going to be the salvation of God to all mankind. And much good is going to be brought, not only at that time, but in the future also. Verse 21, now therefore fear not. I will sustain you. So he's comforting them now. He's reassuring them now. Maybe before that, they didn't feel that he's going to do that. Maybe he was, you know, at fault at that. He didn't do that. He didn't make it clear, because obviously why would they be fearful so, you know, so greatly of him unless he had done that. And so he's doing, in essence, the eighth law. He's reaffirming his love toward them. You see, he's reassuring them. And so he's comforting them. You see, he said, I will sustain you. He's reassuring them and your little ones. And he comforted them and he spoke kindly unto them. You see, the last few laws of the process that we talked about, that's what is happening here. So he himself, you know, is going over and above and beyond that, which he didn't go before. He himself is learning more. You know, he was totally shocked at, you know, their fear of him, that, you know, he realized he hasn't done the job properly as he should have, and so now he's doing it. And so Joseph dwelt in Egypt, he and his father's house, you see, and that's all of his brothers, and Joseph lived 110 years, And Joseph saw Ephraim's children of the third generation, the children also of Machir, the son of Manasseh, as his grandchildren, were born upon Joseph's knees. And you can imagine at this point now all the joys and celebrations and total reconciliation and love and affection between all the brothers. The whole process, 17 years later, was finally finished. And it could have been finished earlier. And much pain and affliction and fears could have been avoided all this time. That's another lesson for us. You know, don't do half a job, or partial job, or 90% of the job. Go all the way. That's God. What He starts, He finishes. And Joseph said unto his brethren, I die, but God will surely remember you. And he knows that. And Jacob told him that, as Jacob was told by God, look, I'm coming, you know, you're going down to Egypt, but I'm coming down with you. Don't worry about it. You see? I'll bring you up here. And so that's what Joseph is passing on to the brothers. And so he says, God will surely remember you and bring you up out of this land unto the land which He swore to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. You know, all your fathers, grandfathers, great-grandfathers. And at this time, you know, they're totally reconciled. You know, he can be sure that they're going to do it. Of course, they themselves are not necessarily going to do it, but they're going to pass it on to their children. When that happens, you know, they would do it. And certainly they did it. And the brethren made sure. Their kids, you know, heard all about it, and their children, grandchildren knew all about it. And you can see the end result again of the reconciliation here. And so Joseph took an oath of the children of Israel, saying, you know, of his brothers, God will surely remember you, and you shall carry up my bones. And mind you, and before that we mentioned that Jacob himself took an oath of Joseph. It's not that he doesn't trust Joseph, and it's not that Joseph doesn't trust the brethren, but no, it's a part of the process, and God himself uses this process. When he makes promises to us, he also swears, and he swore by his own name that he's going to do it. You see? And that's the reason why he wants us to, when we carry the name of God, not to do it in vain, and when we swear not to do it in vain, to be men of honesty. When people are not honest, they should not even use that process. Just say yea or nay. And so he says, God will surely remember you, and you shall carry up my bones from hence. And so Joseph died, you know, peacefully. He knew everything is okay. He's reconciled to his brethren totally. There is no problem there. He now can die in peace. And so he died being 110 years old. And they embalmed him, you know, just like he did to his father, because obviously he's going to be around for a while. And he was put in a coffin in Egypt. And so when, again, you know, if you're going to go and dig there, you know, the grave of both Jacob and Joseph, these are the only two of the fathers, you're going to find a couple of mummies there. And recently, as I mentioned earlier, the Palestinians defiled the grave of Joseph. You know, they don't care much about it because that's the kind of people they are. And yet, God is not going to forsake Joseph either, and Jacob, and none of us. You know, even though we may be in the grave, is going to bring us back to life. And so that's, in essence, the finishing of the book of Genesis. And then we're going to go to Exodus. But in essence, the story continues. You know, these are just, in essence, divisions in the same story. So in that sense, you know, the story continues. So now we continue now with the book of, what is called Exodus. In other words, the exit. And we read in chapter 1, and now these are the names of the sons of Israel. Again, the genealogy, which is always very important from the point of view of God. And when you think about many other things, you begin to understand why it's always necessary for God to repeat these matters. And why people in time to come and always needed to know, you know, what's your genealogy? Where do you come from? And, you know, genealogy of Jesus Christ and genealogy of David and others. Those things were important, and based on that, you know, they determine whether you are really a priest or a Levite, or whether you can function in the temple, and, you know, the land also was based on that, on your genealogy and so forth. Nowadays, you know, we don't know who's our grandfather or great-grandfather. You know, many people don't even know who's their father. That's how far we departed from that way of life. But anyway, here we read, and now these are the names of the sons of Israel who came into Egypt with Jacob. Every man came with his household. So there were a lot of people there, even though only the head of the household is mentioned. So oftentimes in the census that God takes, he mentions only the head of the household. And that doesn't tell you ultimately how many people came down to Egypt with Jacob. Because only the head of the household was mentioned. And Reuben is the first one again. Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, Benjamin, Dan and Naphtali, Gad and Asher, and all the souls that came out of the loins of Jacob were 70 souls, and Joseph was in Egypt already. And Joseph died, and all his brethren, and all that generation. So far so good. They lived long life in the land of Goshen, abundantly blessed. God was with them. God was with Egypt too. All of Egypt was basically reaping the benefit of the children of Israel being there, and the measure of righteousness that they have learned from them, hopefully, and walked in it. And but as time went by, people get rich, and you know what happens. And that's exactly what we're going to read here. Something happened. And Joseph died, and all his brethren, all the generation, and the children of Israel were fruitful, and increased abundantly, and multiplied, and waxed exceeding mighty. Look how much God was with them. And the land was filled with them. Now, between verse 7 and verse 8, something happened. It's not something out of the blue. Now there arose a new king over Egypt who knew not Joseph. And of course, you study history, you begin to understand what was happening here. Now, the Hyksos were defeated by the natives, and they basically got rid of them, and took over. And they were not that much interested in Joseph. They, you know, he was not a part of them. He was a part of the other dynasty, and they didn't care much about his brothers and all the remnant there. So obviously, things were different. But at the same time, why did this happen? Is it just, the natives, decided to rebel and take over? And then new dynasty rose and they couldn't care less about Joseph? Something is hiding there between the lines. Something is missing, which at this point God is not revealing. Until you get down to the prophets. And when you go to the prophets, which we're going to do at this point now, because that's important to know, again, why things are the way they are. And here again, God is going to apply the seven laws of successful correction. And of course, because of the carnality, that they were never willing to submit to this process, obviously there was no success there. But that's not the end of the story. God has not finished with it. That's why we read earlier. As he told Joseph, that is Jacob. In spite of all that you've done, you are still my servant. And I'm going to blot out all of your sins and iniquities. And I'm going to redeem you. He says, as a matter of fact, I've already redeemed you. As far as I'm concerned, you are already redeemed. And so what is it that happens in between? Beside, the usual, so to speak, the mechanics, the way it happened. People look at the mechanics and think that's the reality of the whole thing, and it's not. Now, what happened in between? Between Joseph and this point where a new king arises. Now, arises there, that doesn't know even Joseph. And then he begins, the first thing he does is read in verse 9. A new king arose over Egypt, not Joseph. What is the first thing that comes into his mouth? And he said unto his people, behold, the people of the children of Israel are too many and too mighty for us. Come, let us deal wisely with them, lest they multiply. And it come to pass that when there befalls us any war, in other words, that we just overthrew those Hyksos, they might help them to come back, because after all, they were together with them, they did a lot of good for them. So obviously he thought the children of Israel are going to overthrow, the new dynasty that took over now from the Hyksos, and they're going to restore the Hyksos and so forth. You say, well, these are the human things that are happening, but what's really behind it? Where is God in all that? You see, where was God, when the brothers of Joseph, meant evil, wanted to sell him? You see, people don't see it. And so they don't see God in the process. They just, look at what they're reading here. And from that point of view, they try to understand, and they really don't understand what's happening. See, if you look at the movie, The Ten Commandments, you really don't know what brought Israel to that condition. You see, and when you go to the average Jew, and ask him or the rabbi, what happened there in Egypt, how did they end up as slaves, so they'll tell you all those bad guys, Pharaoh, bad Pharaoh, you see. That's what he did to us, evil. They'll tell you the same thing about Nebuchadnezzar and about, Assyria. You see, they don't tell you about all the in-between, what brought about this whole situation there, this whole scenario. In other words, they're not going to tell you, how God looked at it, what God allowed, what was he working there, you see. They're not going to tell you about the whole process of correction. That's the reason why all these things are happening. And so when you read this story, therefore, when Pharaoh says, therefore, verse 11, they did set over them taskmasters to afflict them with their burdens, and they built for Pharaoh store cities, Pithom and Ramses. But the more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied, you see, and the more they spread abroad. But still, mind you, from being on top of the world, so to speak, they're at the bottom now again. What happened? How do the people of God get to that point? Well, what is God doing here? Here it is. All the examples of the servants of God, like Paul, top of the world, he was one of the chief disciples of Gamaliel, and, was mighty in his community. And then God strikes him down. And where is he now? Nobody. All of his peers, all of his friends, all of those that have known him, they look at him, he's Paul, following Christ. What's the matter with you? Are you crazy? From top to bottom. And Joseph, top to bottom. What's happening here? What's wrong? What have I done wrong? You see, people don't see those kind of things. And the people of Israel, being generally blind, they never saw. Why did Nebuchadnezzar come? They don't see why Assyria came. They don't understand why did Johnny die. They just sort of accuse God. Why did Johnny die if God is love? And that's the way it goes.
All right.
Let's find out. Why did Israel end up here? Why do we end up oftentimes where we are? One way or the other, we may not realize it. And so let's go to God himself, and from his own point of view, let him explain what happened to his people. Why did he forsake them? After they were at the top of the world, he blessed them abundantly. He gave them riches. They were in the land of Goshen. All the cattle of Egypt was in their hand. And so what happened? Why are they here at this point? Okay, in the book of Ezekiel, there are several places here we're going to go through, because we need to understand, so we can understand the mind of God, the law of God, the nature of God. And as we went through this process of the seven laws of successful correction, we're going to understand that too also from this point of view. And so in Ezekiel chapter 20, this is what we read. In essence, chapter 20 is the whole chapter that covers the history of Israel from the days that they went into Egypt to the days going to bring them out of the great captivity in the future. All in one chapter. And so we're going to read it because that's very relevant. In Ezekiel chapter 20, and it came to pass in the seventh year and the fifth month, on the tenth day of the month, that certain of the elders of Israel came to inquire of the Lord and sat before him. Nice people. They're coming to inquire of God. You know, they're all in captivity. And then they come to seek the Lord. You know, a lot of people are that way. But they forget what they're carrying with them. And so, then the word of the Lord came to me saying, and now here's the reaction of God, how he feels about it. From a human point of view, you think, you know, what's wrong with that? You know, that's nice. People go to inquire of God. That's not the way God sees it. And so in verse 3 he says, Son of man, speak to the elders of Israel and say to them, Thus says the Lord God, have you come to inquire of me? As I live, says the Lord God, I will not be inquired of you. You see, I'm not interested in you around here. Don't do me any favors. Don't pretend to be righteous people who come to inquire of God. A lot of people are that way. And then he says to Ezekiel, Will you judge them, son of man? Will you judge them? Then make known to them the abominations of their fathers. Okay? You want to know, you know, why I feel that way? Okay, let's talk about it. You know, let's start the process of correction here. I'm going to put the spotlight on your iniquities, you see? And I'm going to let you know why all these things have come upon you. And you think that you are going to inquire of me just like that, you know, as if you've done nothing wrong. So it says, say to them, Thus says the Lord God, On the day when I chose Israel and raised my hand in an oath to the descendants of the house of Jacob and made myself known to them in the land of Egypt, you know, and only begun the process with Abraham, he says, I raised my hand in an oath. We mentioned earlier, you know, the process of oath that is always there, saying, I am the Lord your God. You know, why does he need to swear and say, I am the Lord your God? You know, why just say, you know, I am the Lord your God? You see, a lot of people don't understand the purpose of making an oath. And the solemn process that goes into it, you know, the assurance that God gives us when he swears by himself. So it says, On that day I raised my hand in an oath. You know, this is the third time to bring them out of the land of Egypt into a land that I had searched out for them, flowing with milk and honey, the glory of the land. You know, look what I was willing to do for them in contrast to what they have done. And then I said to them, Each of you, throw away the abominations which are before your eyes and do not defile yourselves with the idols of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. You see, when we begin to ask the question, what happened between Joseph and the new king that arose that didn't know Joseph and couldn't care less about him? And now he's turning around and oppressing Israel. Who is the one that raised that Pharaoh? Who is the one that caused that revolution to occur there? Throw away the good Hyksos, with whom the Israelites had wonderful relationship, and put on an evil king instead. Who was causing it? Who created the evil? The evil Pharaoh. And all the horrible things he had done to Israel, you know, killing all their children, destroying them as soon as they are born, throw them, you know, and threw them into the river, beside the fact that he already enslaved them, made their life bitter and miserable. Who did it? You see? If you went and told them those kind of things at the time, just like today, they'll make fun of you, you know, mock you, you know. And say, no, our God would never do a thing like that. Our God is God of love, you know. And others would say, you know, if God is God of love, well, how come? Yeah, same old story to this very day. And so he said, I told you there in the land of Egypt, because that's how they degenerated with all the blessings and riches he gave them. And so how is he going to restore them to himself? How is he going to marry them, make them his people? How is he going to reconcile them to them? Reconcile them to himself, that is. But through this process of correction, from the beginning until the end, and what they had to go through for that. That's the reason for the slavery in Egypt, and they certainly don't present that in the Ten Commandments movie. But because people don't like to see these kind of things. We hate correction. But they rebelled against me, he said, and would not obey me. Imagine that. They did not all cast away the abominations which were before their eyes. And that's obviously, you know, the brothers died and their kids were not following in their footsteps. No more than the children of Jacob followed in his footsteps as they should have. You know, they still had their idols before he came down to Egypt. And so idolatry remained there, and wickedness and evil, and that was widespread. And they went for the idols of Egypt too. Beside the idols they brought with them from Canaan, or at least, you know, reinvented them all over again. And so he says, neither did they forsake the idols of Egypt. Then I said, I will pour out my fury on them and fulfill my anger against them in the midst of the land of Egypt. So he talked to them, he spoke to them, he sent prophets to them. We have no name of those prophets. God didn't choose to record any names there, but it's a fact that he said that he did it. He told them those things. When and how and where and what condition, under what circumstances, what they've done with them. We don't know all those things. We do know the history of Israel and all the prophets that came to them and how they act to this very day. So one of these days we're going to uncover an awful lot of history of Israel that was not recorded. And this is a part of it here. And so he said, you know, we're so angry with them that he was going to pour his fury upon them right there in the land of Egypt. But I acted for my name's sake, that it should not be profaned before the Gentiles among whom they were, in whose sight I had made myself known to them, to bring them out of the land of Egypt. Therefore I made them go out of the land of Egypt, and brought them into the wilderness. Not because they were good, they were repenting, they were turning away, they were not going through the process, but God in his grace and mercy was doing it for them. And yet without repentance on our part and turning around, you know, of what value is his goodness and grace and mercy, you see? That's what people don't realize that. You know, they made his mercy and grace, you know, cheap. And they did not really uproot that out of their heart and minds. They did not circumcise the foreskin of their hearts. And that's what the purpose of all the trials that God allows us to go through and to be afflicted with, so that we can circumcise the foreskin of our heart from the beginning of life, and learn to hate evil, and learn to hate it in ourselves and in others, and know how it feels, and then not do it to others, so forth. And so, verse 12, moreover, I also gave them my Sabbath, right there in Egypt, and they let on. They were totally ignorant. You know, before they came to Mount Sinai, he already talked about the Sabbath in Exodus 16. So he said, moreover, I also gave them my Sabbath to be a sign between them and me, and that they might know that I am the Lord who sanctifies them. Yet the house of Israel rebelled against me. And that's obviously after he brought them back to the land, and even in the wilderness. And they rebelled against me in the wilderness, and they did not walk in my statutes. They despised my judgments, which if a man does, he shall live by them. And they greatly defiled my Sabbath. Then I said, I would pour out my fury on them in the wilderness to consume them. So even in the wilderness, he wanted to destroy them. But I acted for my name's sake, that it should not be profaned before the Gentiles, in whose sight I had brought them out. So I also raised my hand in an oath again now, in an oath, not for their own good, you see. And because I never appreciated that, his oath to them was meaningless. But he raises his hand, he said, in an oath to them in the wilderness, that I would not bring them into the land which I had given them, flowing with milk and honey, the glory of all the lands. Why? Because they have despised my judgments and did not walk in my statutes and profaned my Sabbaths, for their heart went after their idols. They were not willing to go through this process of correction. Nevertheless, my eyes spared them from destruction, and I did not make an end of them in the wilderness. But I said, to their children in the wilderness, do not walk in the statutes of your fathers, nor observe their judgments, nor defile yourselves with their idols. I am the Lord your God. Walk in my statutes, keep my judgments, and do them. Hallow my Sabbath, and they will be a sign between me and you. And to this very day, people will mock you if you tell them that this is the Sabbath that God wanted them to keep. Well, anyway, we're going to stop at this point again. This is Mordecai Joseph. Greetings to all of God's people. Until next time.